Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. COVID-19 has presented many challenges to us as a nation and a society. But when you strip away the politics, it's really all about science and medicine, the biology of the coronavirus, our immune response, and our quest to develop vaccines to prevent infection and medications to treat the illness. My guest today is a scientist and researcher looking to catalog the world's plants, estimated to be at more than 300,000 different species, some 9% of which it's estimated have been used over the centuries for medicinal purposes. Of course, as our planet warms and the climate changes, many plants may become extinct before we ever even catalog them, setting up a race against time. What if a plant with an ability to overcome antibiotic-resistant pathogens is out there? Dr. Cassandra Quave is an ethnobotanist on the faculty of the Emory University School of Medicine in Atlanta. She's a prolific scientist, curator of the university's herbarium, and host of a podcast called Foodie Pharmacology. Quave has overcome many challenges, including birth defects that led to one of her legs being amputated at age 3, to learning how to deal with unwanted sexual advances and bullying in the scientific realm. Her new memoir is called The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. Dr. Cassandra Quave of Emory University is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Cassandra Quave, welcome to Medical Monday. Your memoir is really powerful, The Plant Hunter, that is you. The subtitle, Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. You've overcome a lot in your life, and I guess the early part of the book is a bit about your life story and how you wound up becoming an ethnobotanist. So I guess let's start there. You had a congenital condition that led to some, I guess you could call it bone malformation. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I was born with multiple congenital skeletal deformities, including the lack of a fibula on my right side. My femur and tibia were both very short, and I was missing several bones in my right foot. And so there was, you know, a whole sequence of issues there. And as I grew older, also later developed hip dysplasia and had really severe scoliosis. So I really had to have a number of corrective orthopedic surgeries throughout my childhood, up to, you know, one, sometimes two a year, to revise the stump and also fix my hip and lengthen my femur, fix my back, and so on.
Yeah, and it wasn't just that you had an amputation when you were 3 years old, which you write about, but it was these multiple sequential surgeries, because as you grew, I guess you continued to develop bone spurs that would sort of come off the stump of the tibia. Is that what happened? And then you had to have those revised or fixed.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened. So like every growth spurt I had, I'd get these spurs that would basically grow through the tissue. And one of the challenges was that I had very little fatty tissue under the bone, because following that amputation when I was 3, I also acquired a hospital infection of staph. And this basically caused a tremendous amount of damage to my tissue. They had to go back in and revise the stump further. So I have a very, very short stump. It's like just about at the bare minimum you need to actually have a below-the-knee prosthetic. But it's basically bone on scar tissue, and that's it. There's no kind of padding beneath that. So really, there was no room for bone when my bones did grow. They just would grow straight through the scar tissue. And so that obviously was very painful and required recurrent revisions.
So you write about being a school-age kid and talking to your peers, and they would say things like, what did you do over your summer vacation? Or what, you know? And you often for you, it was like, oh, I was in the hospital. I mean, that it was a very formative part of your childhood.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I spent a lot of time in the hospital. It's like, it's funny though, the household I grew up in, my parents, especially my mom, was like really big into healthy food, and we never had candy or kind of junk food around the house. And so ironically, a lot of the times I would get my kind of sweets, you know, would be the popsicles in the hospital. And I remember once coming out of surgery and having a new nurse that had never worked with me before. I was probably, I don't know, like 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, I was right out of surgery and I shouldn't be eating anything that early out of surgery, but I convinced her to get me a cherry popsicle, and it tasted just as good as it did going down as it did coming up.
Oh, no.
I couldn't hold those down very well after surgery. But yeah, I spent a lot of time in the hospital.
Wow. And so, you know, and now your chosen field, first, I guess I'll come to this because obviously being an amputee, you wear a prosthetic leg, or you, as you write in the book, you have multiple prostheses, and you've, over the years, as the science has improved and some of the technology in the devices that you can wear, I think though the fit has improved for you, and so your ability to, but you're out trekking essentially in jungles a lot of the time, or swamps, as the case may be in Florida. And, you know, you're based in Atlanta, but you recount many journeys both to Italy and several to South America that were very formative in getting you to where you are now. And I guess, so let's start with, like, what it's like, I guess, to wear a prosthesis and going onto, like, unstable ground a lot of the time.
Yeah, that's a great question. The prosthetic technology has improved tremendously. When I was a kid, you know, they were very heavy. They were rock hard. I don't know what exactly they made them of, but they were very hard, heavy. There wasn't really much motion in the ankle. And I often had to wear straps around the thigh that would be very tight to hold them on, or very tight sleeves, kind of as a vacuum sleeve, or at some cases, even around kind of up higher around my waist to keep it on. And as I got older, there have been just so many advances. I think the most important advance for me, at least, has been the transition away from socks that could cause a lot of friction on the skin to more of a silicone liner that you put against the skin when you wear the prosthetic. That for me was a game changer because, you know, I was a very active kid. I was always outdoors in the mud, playing outside, growing up in Florida, and that heat and sweat and friction made me really prone to kind of recurrent skin infections on the stump, which would result in me being immobilized while those infections healed and the swelling went down. So nowadays we have these better kind of liners that are much nicer for the skin, but still, you know, it's not necessarily easy, also because of my other series of issues that I have with my back and my hip and my femur. You know, pain is something I've just had to learn to deal with my whole life. And I have to know what my limits are when I'm out in the field and build in time for breaks and rest. And I've been really fortunate to have very supportive team members and collaborators that understand, like, you know, I'm going to be a little bit slower than they are, but, you know, I may need to take more breaks, but I'm definitely out there to get the job done and really have a lot of fun while I'm out there. It just takes a little bit more advanced planning and sometimes a mule or a canoe or whatever else I can use to get as close as I can to where I need to get to collect the plants.
Cassandra Quave, I was wondering if you could define what ethnobotany is, because I've heard the term, but until I read your book and really thought about it, I didn't really know what it actually meant either. And I think your parents were kind of flummoxed. You write about that because all along, you know, as we've already talked about, you had these very formative medical experiences as a youngster and many times hospitalized. And so I think had this motivation to help others and go to medical school. And lo and behold, after getting into medical school, you sort of changed your mind and thought about ethnobotany, and your parents basically said, ethno what? So tell us what that is.
Yeah. Ethnobotany is the science of survival. So it's basically the scientific study of how people interact with plants in nature, whether it's for food, for medicine, for tools, for construction, art, music, all of those things under that umbrella. And you're absolutely right. I was very much raised under this very strict Western medical paradigm where, for me, the definition of medicine was really a balance between pharmacology and surgery. And I hadn't given much thought to other ways of understanding medicine really until I got to college and started taking more courses in anthropology and was exposed to different cultures, and especially in medical anthropology, when I started to think more about different systems of medicine. And then later, when I read about ethnobotany for the first time, that just kind of seemed to put a lot of pieces to the puzzle in place that united my interest in science and medicine and culture together. And it was really that formative experience of going to the Amazon and having the opportunity to work with and study under an indigenous healer, Don Antonio Montero Pisco, that, you know, really he opened my eyes to the other facets of medicine that I hadn't really seen before, you know, that it also can involve an appreciation for spiritual or ritualistic aspects. But also what he taught me was really a history lesson in that many of our medicines have come from nature, and there are many more that can come from nature if we just take the time to look.
Yeah, so there's an estimate in the book. I mean, so there's a very, surprisingly to me anyway, probably to many of your readers, low percentage of botanicals that have been essentially classified or categorized. Where do you sort of estimate that figure? And I guess, you know, how many more are there out there to discover?
There are estimates that there are around 374,000 species of plants on Earth, and roughly 9% of those, or around 33,000, have been recorded at some point as being used in medicine. That's a pretty big number when you think about it, 33,000 species, because when you think about the number of species that we actually rely on today for food and for medicine, that number is really low. And when it comes to the scientific study of plants, and I'm talking about like not just a cursory look, but like a really in-depth look at the chemistry and pharmacological potential of plants, we're still probably in the very low hundreds of species that have been really rigorously investigated. And so, you know, for me, there's a sense of urgency because, number one, billions of people across the globe rely on plants as their primary form of medicine, which isn't, you know, perhaps a novel kind of concept to many of us in the US, where we just walk over, you know, to your local drugstore to pick up your aspirin or your, you know, medicine for a stomach ache. But for many people in the world, they turn to the plants that they find in their environment to treat those kind of common ailments. And at the same time, you know, scientists don't really know how those plants work. Do they work? Which compounds are responsible? Are they safe? And what's the mechanistic basis for those that do work in people? And so it's just a, you know, tremendous area for exploration. And one of the hopes of this book that I have for the book, at least, is that it will inspire others to really think about getting into this field. There's so many different ways we can approach these issues, and so many, I think, really big scientific breakthroughs that are just waiting to happen.
Yeah. And you write, you know, a whole chapter on Don Antonio, and that first experience, I think, was when you were in college and what that was like. And it, I guess not only did you learn about sort of the shamanistic and historical aspects of healing and using local plants, but just the incredibly deep knowledge that these folks have for what grows in their environment and sort of the knowledge of the plants themselves, and then the different preparations that are used for varieties of illnesses or symptoms. And it's and then, of course, you could call it, I mean, we don't bedside manner or something. I mean, there's this whole ability to kind of calm and soothe that's part of the art of it, in a way that, you know, is in some ways reminiscent of westernized medicine, but in obviously many ways is extraordinarily different. It sounds like that's influenced your work and thought process quite a bit, because in a different chapter, you go back, I think, into the Amazon, and I think it's Peru, and it looks like worked with or shadow, I forget the term, but a local public health official who's, I think, a doctor. And what's disappointing in a way, and it's a resource-constrained environment, is he's able to kind of go out and be responsible for their health and diagnose a lot of folks, but it's so resource-poor, so he can basically advise the mom of this sick child to sort of go to the faraway town or the nearest town, which is a difficult journey away, to get medicine. And you sort of say, well, you know, will she do it? And he says, well, no, not probably not, you know, and like he's worried about the kid. And so I just wondered about your reaction to that, and then what it must be like, of course, for those practitioners to have so much knowledge but have such limited resources with which to try to affect change or healing or help.
Yeah. I mean, and in that chapter, I really tried to explore some of the bigger questions that I was experiencing at that time in my career development, and really around what happens when Western ideologies or Western medicine, in this case, pushes out traditional knowledge. Because what was just so shocking to me about these scenarios is like a lot of the child health in that region was very poor because of very high intestinal parasite loads that these kids have, because they're drinking water straight out of the river, you know, they're running around barefoot. So you have all these different helminths that get into their guts. And I knew from my work with Don Antonio that historically in the region, they had a plant that they would take for kind of like as a regular dewormer for kids. I mean, I had worms as a kid from running barefoot in Florida. I mean, my parents got me a pill and it cleared up the problem, and that was that. But in many places, that's not possible. And so what happens is when you live with these extremely high loads of intestinal parasites, there are all these other health consequences, you know, including a higher propensity for anemia, you know, increased incidence of respiratory infections, in addition to gastrointestinal distress. And it's also a malaria endemic zone. So, you know, they're just generally much more weakened. And when you think about this, you know, in these communities, the plant that was traditionally used is still there. And some of the locals even knew that this was a plant that was used in the past for removing worms from the body, but they didn't know about the dosing and they were afraid to give it to their children because at the wrong dose, just like in Western medicine, if you give a patient the wrong dose of something, it can have some bad side effects. And when these kids have such a high parasite load, those side effects can be even worse. And so it was just such a paradox for me. It was such a clear example of what happens when well-intentioned public health initiatives to introduce modern medicine to a region, you know, fall short because they basically didn't replenish the supplies of medicines. And in the meantime, pushing out these traditional modes of medicine. So it just really got me thinking about there has to be a better way of meeting the middle to perhaps, you know, have an integration of both systems of medicine, or at the very least, you know, have better information around how to use those local resources. And that was just really impactful for me to see that.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. And my guest today is Dr. Cassandra Quave, the plant hunter. That's the name of her memoir, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. She's an associate professor of dermatology and human health at Emory University School of Medicine. She's a medical botanist and also specifically with an ethnobotanist, which is, we've learned, is the interaction between the plant world and human cultures in a variety of manners. And Cassandra, you also host a podcast called Foodie Pharmacology. Tell us a little bit about the podcast.
Foodie Pharmacology, we're now in our third season. And in this podcast, I get a chance to really explore those connections between food and medicine. And I write about these, you know, this idea of the food medicine continuum in one of the chapters in the book where I am working in Italy for the first time. And in this case, you know, I am working with some different healers, but also connecting with a lot of just elders in these communities and learning about the ways that they kind of use food as their medicine, especially kind of bitter wild greens as a, you know, major component of the Mediterranean diet that I think we don't discuss enough in the scientific literature. We focus primarily on this idea of vegetables, olive oil, red wine, but the type of vegetables really matters because these are, you know, intensely rich in sources of antioxidants that can be added to the diet to kind of reduce inflammation. But in the podcast, we talk with lots of different guests, authors and scientists. We get into the pharmacology of how some of these different ingredients interact with body pathways. We actually just last year had Dr. David Julius, who just won the Nobel Prize, by the way, in medicine, on the show. And he explained his work on capsaicin from chili peppers on pain receptors and kind of the science behind pain, which was really fascinating. We've had just a lot of fabulous guests. And for me, you know, it's just been such a pleasure to get to meet people. It gives me an excuse to reach out to, you know, authors of whose books I'm really fascinated with, and also the scientists whose work I'm following, and gets me a chance to get to know them and share their work with the public.
Tell us too about the herbarium, and that is that part of Emory, and you're the curator of the herbarium, and I'm guessing that's just sort of a museum, you know, quote unquote, if you will, about different kinds of plants and herbs.
Yeah, absolutely. So you nailed it. An herbarium is a natural history museum. This is where we store pressed plants. So these are plants that we collect in the wild. We collect data on where they're located, when they're collected, you know, how they're used in different locations where they're collected. And these are dried and pressed flat and glued onto acid-free paper and can last 500 to 600 years at least if cared for properly. So these are, you know, it's not only a kind of a museum collection, but it's also a working research collection. And this is where we deposit specimens of any of the plants that we're doing our drug discovery research on. It's kind of an authentication or a sign of physical proof that the plants where we say we're extracting in a lab are actually the species that we say they are. Because botanical taxonomy, you know, is tricky and you don't want to find the next cure for something and have the wrong plant name, right? So it's having that physical proof is really important to that process.
Yeah. And, you know, you detail in the memoir about just kind of the painstaking labor that's involved in going to one of these, and I don't know what you call them, like dig sites essentially, or just a, you know, a field work, you know, gathering. Mm-hmm. Take us through what a typical, you know, session or day in that world might be like with you and, you know, your research assistants or grad students.
So I guess, you know, on the front end, there's a lot of work that goes into preparing for a field expedition, especially for international expeditions. There are international collaborative agreements that are set in place, typically with other university researchers that we're collaborating with. You know, you have to get the funding to support these, which is also a whole other intensive process. We also need to communicate with the communities and kind of establish, you know, agreements and permissions to ensure that they are okay with us coming to work in their communities and that we have the prior informed consent of leadership there. And then also when we arrive, that we have consent to work with specific individuals in the communities. So let's fast forward through all of that and imagine that we're in the field. You know, often our days start before dawn. So it's actually much better for us to start just as the sun is rising, because, you know, it can get really, really hot. And this is really heavy duty outdoor work for the most part when we're out collecting. It may require, as I mentioned before, some form of transportation to get to the collection site that we're trying to get to. So that can take some time. And we're carrying with us all this gear. So we have clippers, we have herbarium plant presses, which are basically the size of an open, you know, a folded sheet of newspaper, basically in dimension. These are wooden slats with straps that we can press those plants in tightly to dry them that way. We also have large collection bags that our bulk specimens are collected into, and those are the ones that come back to the laboratory for chemical extraction and analysis against our different biological assays that we run in our drug searches. And so we're working like that in the morning until probably around mid-morning before lunch. We will head back and process those samples, have lunch, and then we often spend the afternoon in interviews with local people, because we're also not only collecting specimens, we're also talking to locals about the traditional uses of different plants. So we know best which plants to actually be looking for as we're out collecting. And these are very long days. You know, we often end up working well into the evening, and then the next day it's back up and early again. And, you know, as a mom, a lot of these field expeditions I've had, we've had our kids with us. So, and my husband with us too. And so it's also kind of juggling all of that and making sure the kids are good and they've, you know, been fed and have something to do during the day while we're out, you know, collecting plants, or in many cases are out with us collecting plants too.
That's really neat that you can bring your family along and sort of, I hope they share in the joy. I mean, in the hard work part, they may not be so able to sort of sustain the level of interest. But that's a really good point. I mean, being a mom of three kids, or I guess now a fourth as well that you've adopted, but and a husband, how do you juggle it all, you know, being a family person and, you know, having this pretty active career? And as we've talked about too, you know, overcoming a disability in really impressive fashion.
I mean, I think there's a couple of really important factors. Number one is I have a really supportive partner. My husband's been incredibly supportive of my career from day one. And I couldn't have done what I do without him. And, you know, I've had a very supportive family too, especially in our field work in Italy, where he is from. You know, we've had help from grandparents and watching the kids and things, especially when they were younger. You know, today when we're in the field, they're older now. Three of them are teenagers. I've got one in elementary school. But, you know, even when they were in elementary and middle school, they would spend a lot of time in the villages just running around playing soccer, hanging out with the local kids. I mean, they actually really treasure those times and have really loved the time in the field. And, you know, if they're with us out on a collecting day, it's usually watching, sometimes helping collect stuff, but they're not working nearly as hard as the graduate students and we are, you know. But they do enjoy kind of getting out and exploring nature. And it's been a great way to expose them to different, you know, different cultures as well. I guess the other thing that's really helped me, and in a way, you know, because of the struggles that I faced from early childhood, it really fostered a sense of resilience in me. You know, I mean, when you think about all the times when I was young and just trying to learn how to walk with a prosthetic, I mean, you have to, when you're faced with constant failure, you have two paths you can choose. One is to pick yourself back up and try again, expecting that you just might fall again, but it's okay. You can pick yourself back up and try again until you kind of make it forward. I mean, my whole life has kind of been a training camp for that, just because of those disabilities. And, you know, I also really gained a lot from watching my parents. I mean, my dad has this incredibly hard work ethic. You know, he works outdoors, and, you know, both my mom and he are very creative. And I just, you know, very much do-it-yourself type of people. And, you know, that definitely rubbed off on me. It helped me kind of overcome a lot of those hurdles that I encountered later in my career and in science and in life.
You know, you're often in these environments as a scientist where it's sort of a male dominated. And so you're one of the few women and you're very successful at that. But that's not always so easy. And as you just pointed out, you've overcome quite a bit in your life. But you detail at least one account in the book of someone making an unwanted advance at you. And so you've also done some work in that regard with a researcher's code of conduct. Can you explain a little bit about that?
Yeah, in the book, I kind of explored these three archetypes that I think many women in science, or many professional women, period, have had to encounter. There is a Professor Snake, who's kind of, you know, the bully that you encounter. Professor Creeper, who is, you know, the creepy person that just keeps hitting on you or makes unwanted advances in a professional setting. And there's also Professor Toad, who makes you feel like you don't belong because he can't believe that you're there or who you say you are. So like, there are those kind of three archetypes, and they have little stories on those. But the reality is, those few stories are just one of many instances that I've unfortunately encountered people like this in my life and career. And again, I think that's something that many, many people have dealt with. So one of the things that I wanted to address in the book, and I didn't want to sugarcoat things. I mean, on one hand, I want to share the joy and the incredible journey it is to be a scientist and to be able to explore those questions that just really set your heart on fire, that make you passionate, that really, you know, gives you satisfaction in knowing that you're making some contribution that could help other people someday. I wanted to share that, but I didn't want to sugarcoat it and say, hey, it's all roses, because it's not. You know, there's also some corpse plant moments in there as well. And in the case, you know, I talked about, you know, the types of actions that I've taken that I wasn't able to take early on in my career, because, you know, when I was faced with these types of encounters, I didn't know what to do. And so I really tried to advocate for the inclusion of codes of conduct at scientific conferences as a starting place to ensure that these places are safe for women to participate and to have a means of reporting, you know, unacceptable behavior such as bullying or sexual harassment, so that they could continue to participate in a conference without feeling threatened. And, you know, not all societies have these in place. And I've basically reached a point in my career that I just boycott those types of meetings. I won't participate if there's not a code of conduct in place, because I don't want to support that kind of endeavor, because I might be able to stand up for myself now because I'm older now. I feel more confident and be able to speak out. You know, I'm in more of a position of power than I was as a young student, but others that aren't in positions of power certainly wouldn't know what to do or how to speak out. And so I want to make sure that those pathways are in place.
Thank you for exploring that. And congratulations on both your work and on the book. Cassandra Quave, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. This has been a lot of fun.
Dr. Cassandra Quave is an ethnobotanist on the faculty of the Emory University School of Medicine. Her new book is called The Plant Hunter, A Scientist's Quest for Nature's Next Medicines. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.